From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. is set to cross a grim threshold in the pandemic launched just about a year ago by the coronavirus. 400,000 lives lost, according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. That's roughly the city of Tulsa or Tampa or New Orleans, wiped out. And President-elect Biden is attending a memorial tonight for the lives lost. But America spends almost 18% of its GDP on health care, and yet the U.S. leads the world in COVID-19 deaths. Let's check in with Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, epidemiologist with Johns Hopkins. And Dr. Nuzzo, I almost hate to say these large numbers because it almost obscures that each of these is a single important life lost. What populations have been hit hardest?
Well, it's really been remarkably consistent since the beginning, and thank you for pointing that out. We often talk about the data without pausing enough to reflect on the fact that these are individual lives and loved ones that are no longer with us. But, you know, certainly hit hardest, of course, are older adults, people age 60 and over, particularly 80 and older, has been one of the hardest hit. We also know that there has been a disproportionate impact on racial and ethnic minority groups, particularly African American, Latinx. And so, you know, when we think about who has really shouldered the burden, it's not one that we have all shared equally.
Yeah. Well, and we know that one of the big problems is there are people who don't believe that it even exists, still think it's a hoax, are not wearing masks. But where else are the problems in our vaccine rollout? We've missed the 20 million shots that was targeted by the end of 2020. You know, 3 weeks into January, we're not there. Where are the bottlenecks?
Sure. Well, vaccine is obviously the one that's on a lot of people's minds. I know people are very eager to be vaccinated, and that's heartening to hear. That 20 million Americans vaccinated by the end of 2020, that was a projection that was issued without really any plans to enable that projection to be realized. So I think people are feeling disappointed. Those of us who have been tracking the issue and calling for the provision of resources to develop those plans are by no means surprised. I do think that things will get better on the vaccination front soon. We're now finally recognizing that it's not just about developing a vaccine, but also making sure we have the plans to administer it. And states are now working through that fast. Yeah. But we're still seeing bottlenecks in other areas, particular testing. You know, we heard a lot about it over the summer, and it continues to be an issue. In fact, testing has slowed as of late at a time when our case numbers are reaching record highs. And so we really need to double down and expand the number of people who get tested so that we can find everyone who's infected and make sure they can stay home so that they don't spread it to others.
Yeah. And we're hearing reports that the new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus could be the dominant strain in the U.S. as soon as March. And California is reporting another variant first seen in Denmark. Again, more contagious doesn't mean more deadly. It just does lead to more deaths because more people get very sick and overload hospitals. So what do we know about these strains?
Right. Well, I think the first overarching message is that what we need to do to combat them doesn't change. We still need to double down on our public health interventions. Those still work. It's just it increases urgency for us to do it. If more people are getting infected faster, it just means we have to act even faster. But then there's the overarching lesson from this, which is that the longer we let this virus circulate uncontrolled, the more opportunities there are for the virus to mutate and to develop features that we don't want, like enhanced transmissibility. Or we haven't yet seen this, but there still is the possibility that we could see mutations that are either more deadly or worse, in some ways not able to respond to the vaccines that we've developed and the medicines that are now being used.
Yeah. Well, tomorrow, President-elect Biden will become President Biden. He's put Jeff Zients, a former Obama administration official, in charge as his COVID czar. Is this notion that he's mentioned of just 100 days, just masks every day, everybody, it seems so simple. Do you think it will have an impact?
I do. I mean, I think, first of all, we have seen in a number of states when they have been more serious about either requiring masks or being very clear in their messaging about the need for masks, the case numbers have fallen. And so I think having national leadership that talks about the importance of these very simple measures, the same measures that we have been stressing since very close to the beginning of this pandemic as being important for controlling the spread, now we just need to do it. And having leadership at top saying that we need to do this, I think will be important.
Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, epidemiologist with Johns Hopkins, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go to Washington, D.C. now, where security on the streets is tight. Nearly 25,000 National Guard soldiers are stationed in and around the U.S. Capitol. And activist groups are calling for hotels to close to prevent extremists from disrupting tomorrow's inauguration. But these calls for closures are up against another crisis: business owners who are struggling to stay afloat during this pandemic. They've been depending on inauguration visitors to help get them through. Adam Crane is the owner of Adams Inn, a small hotel choosing to stay open. And he joins me now. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So, Adam, we know that Airbnb has canceled all of its bookings there to lessen the chance of outsiders coming in and doing something similar to this month's insurrection. You're choosing to stay open. Tell us more on why.
Well, it's not really my choice. It's my staff's choice. Just on background, and I've been the owner for 20 years of a small business. It's a 27-room inn, bed and breakfast in Adams Morgan in the heart of Washington, D.C. I had, at peak season, I employ a staff of 19. COVID has decimated my business, and our staff now is dwindled down to 5 staff. Revenue is down 85%. Occupancy is down 87%. I gave my staff the option of closing, and they said they wanted to stay open because they need the money. Staying open and closing is the difference between paying their rent and feeding their families. And they decided they wanted to stay open, and so I honored their decision.
I hear exactly what you're saying. You all were also open during the January 6th insurrection, and you later found out, though, that 2 Proud Boys stayed at your hotel along with some other Trump supporters. I mean, this is why some are arguing that you should close, at least for these 2 days. Are you worried about this happening again?
We're not worried about it happening again because all the bookings are clearly Biden Democrats for the inauguration.
How do you know that?
Well, all the bookings came in. We haven't had a single booking since November. And because of the rioters and security, all we had was cancellations. We were fully booked in November for the inauguration, and then now we're only 50% occupied because we've had 50% cancellations because of the lockdown and the security restrictions and the rioting. But frankly, we would stay open. My staff is desperate for money, desperate for pay and hours and wages. They are in and out of poverty. So the difference between, you know, getting paid and not getting paid is for them an economic necessity. It's an economic decision. You know, they're all opposed Trump, and I'm a lifelong Democrat, but they don't have the luxury of saying, well, we'll close to make a political statement.
We know that many of the chain hotels are going to remain open, but they're implementing extra security. You will have 2 maintenance people working security. What other measures for safety are you taking?
We're not taking any other measures for security. The 2 maintenance men I'm employing are going to, they can talk down a guest, and they've been with me 20 years. They can handle an unruly guest, and they have in the past many times. But, you know, Tanya, I want to mention that we got slammed on social media, and we still get harassed. My staff still receives phone calls, belligerent phone calls, asking us why we're remaining open, why we rented to Proud Boys. We clearly didn't mean to rent to Proud Boys. We only found out after the fact, but we got attacked on social media.
What do you wish they knew about the decision you're making, the factors in making this decision to stay open? And do you understand their concerns at all?
You know, I understand that they're obviously against the white supremacists and rioters and the Trump supporters. But what they don't understand is, I wonder how many of these people attacking us on social media actually are small business owners whose business is going down the drain, like mine, or how many of them are low-income immigrants or low-income persons of color and Latinos and African-Americans like my staff, who are struggling to stay out of poverty and depend on a paycheck to, you know, to pay their rent and feed their kids. You know, they're throwing these sort of self-righteous platitudes and empty rhetorical bombs from their pricey condominiums or from their iPhones. But what they're doing is they're dismissing the needs and perspectives of the people that are actually the white supremacists are attacking.
You're going to stay open. What's next for you after this? You said that you're nearly out of business. I mean, because really, what the argument is from folks who are asking you to close is that it's just a day. It's just 2 days. But what you're laying out for us is that This is a bigger problem for you. You're on the brink of closure.
The inauguration and the Trump supporters is a financial decision. It's the only business we've had in the last 10 months. It's the only time we're going to make any money. You know, this is about my staff. It's about my staff who are already either in and out of poverty or low income. You know, they're the priority right now. It's not me. I'm going to be fine, even if my business goes under. For them, it's a difference between, you know, it's their livelihood, and their lives have been decimated.
That's Adam Crane, owner of Adam's Inn, a small hotel in Washington, D.C. that is staying open this week throughout the inauguration. Adam, thank you so much for talking with us, and my best to you and your staff.
Thank you, Tanya. I appreciate it.
This next story contains graphic information. It's about investigative journalist Hopewell Chimwono in prison in Zimbabwe after being denied bail. His goal is to report on corruption, describe graphic human rights abuses. We spoke with him in the fall after an earlier arrest.
My arrest was meant to instill the fear of God in young journalists to say that if we can arrest this big, well-known journalist, Hopewell Chimwono, imagine what we can do with you.
Well, this month, Chimwono was arrested again after posting information that police in Zimbabwe beat an infant to death, which they deny. Doug Coltart is his lawyer. He joins us on Skype. And Doug, where is Hopewell Chimwono? Do you know how he's doing?
Yes, so Hopewell is currently at Chikurubi Maximum Security Prison in Harare. This is a prison reserved for the most heinous criminals and political prisoners like Hopewell. I haven't seen him for some time. Prison authorities were denying lawyers access to him. Subsequently, one of the other lawyers has managed to see him. As far as I know, he's hanging in there, but the conditions in the prison are deplorable, and COVID-19 is rampaging through Zimbabwe, including in our prisons.
Well, we mentioned what the government is accusing him of, you know, not telling the truth about this event. And here's this terrible information. It sounds horrible. Police beating an infant to death? Where does he say he saw this?
So there was a video which was circulating in Zimbabwe. The video depicts a woman confronting a police officer surrounded by a crowd of people. She's holding in her arms a completely limp child, an infant. The crowd is shouting at the police officer, "You kill the child, you kill the child," in Shona, and speaking of the police officer beating the child. So it was widely reported at the time that the child was killed. The police have issued a statement saying, admitting to that there was some form of police brutality, but claiming that the child didn't die. But then instead of dealing with the police brutality, they've gone on an arresting spree. Anyone who commented or allegedly commented on that video, in particular three people, two opposition members, and then Hopewell, two are still in detention, and the third was just released on bail yesterday.
So what do you think happens now to Hopewell?
So right now, Hopewell has appealed against the denial of bail in the magistrate's court. He's appealed to the High Court. It's the same pattern that has been followed in Hopewell's two previous cases, where he's been denied bail at the magistrate's court, which are increasingly politicized. And then generally, we have seen people being granted bail on appeal at the High Court. So we're hopeful that his bail appeal will be successful. That should be coming to court this week or next week.
That's Doug Coltart, who represents journalist Hopewell Chimwono. He's in Harare, Zimbabwe. Doug, thanks for bringing us up to date, and we'll stay in touch. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Remember the rush, the thrill of seeing your favorite performers live? The feeling of the subwoofers in your ribcage, the sweat rolling down your face, the lights flashing, casting beams on a roaring crowd? Well, that was before the pandemic. Right now, all of those places you could count on to catch your favorite performances, they're having to cancel shows and refund tickets and figure out how they'll stay afloat. But there is a bit of hope. The Save Our Stages Act, passed by Congress and signed by the president, allocates $15 billion to independent venues. It was bundled into the larger COVID relief bill. With us to talk more about this is Katie Tutton, co-owner of The Hideout, where garage bands try out their scratchy raw material for small, intimate crowds. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Joe Shanahan, owner of The Metro, a place that can hold more than 1,000 fans. The Metro's marquee regularly sees some of the biggest names in the world. Katie and Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Our pleasure.
Well, the live music scene is so fundamental to Chicago's culture, maybe just like the L train or deep dish pizza. And Katie, The Hideout is a small venue. I'm wondering, what does your financial picture look like right now? What does this money from the government mean to you?
Well, it means the world, actually. Joe and I were talking earlier today, and to quote Joe, we can take a deeper breath now because we see light at the end of the tunnel. There is a glimmer of hope. And so for the last 9 months, we have been struggling and fighting and calling elected officials and such. And we are just so relieved that we were fortunate enough to be included in the COVID relief bill. So really, I mean, it was a godsend.
Yeah.
You know, we're the second most vulnerable employment sector. And with, you know, 71 plus thousand individuals, you know, involved in our business and our clubs and our venues across the nation, This is a big time for us. We need to understand what the language is going to say and how it's going to help
us.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, the $15 billion in the Save Our Stages Act will be distributed through the Small Business Administration. That's actually the same government agency that paid out the Paycheck Protection Program funds to keep small businesses open earlier in the pandemic. Their handling of that program was criticized for giving the biggest loans to a tiny fraction of businesses that needed the money. How confident are you that this new money will be paid out appropriately and in time? Joe, I'll start with you.
Well, that's what we're working on right now, to make sure that the small businesses get this money, get these funds, as opposed to the large more corporate institutions, and keeps to the small independent venues. Mm-hmm.
So, Tonya, we went to great lengths to ensure that priority be given to the businesses who lost 90% of their revenue. And so there are things in place, as Joe said, that the funding as it gets released goes to those that are in most jeopardy first. Mm. There's also an additional $2 billion set aside for businesses that employ fewer than 50 full-time employees.
Mm. Yes, and, mm-hmm. and in conjunction with the National Independent Venue Association, the Chicago Independent Venue League, working together to make sure that the language is clear and understood by each and every venue owner.
Mm-hmm. Joe, let's travel back a bit. It's really hard to imagine that there was a time when the Smashing Pumpkins were once a little-known alt-rock band from Chicago. You actually gave them their start. They went on to perform their farewell show at the Metro. But there are so many artists who are just starting out right now who now don't have a place to perform. Does that worry you?
It does worry me. It worries Katie, too, because of the ecosystem that is clearly present in the city of Chicago. Bands that start at the Hideout, eventually playing the Metro. That is something that we understand, that culturally what's happened in the last 10 months, or let's just say a year, the artists have just come to a complete halt. Some are creating in studios, some are creating in Zooms, but to play for a live audience, that is the key to any progression and any real growth as an artist. And Katie knows this as well as I do. That's what we miss the most, is seeing those artists performing and seeing the smiles on the patrons' faces.
Katie, you work with garage bands. I mean, what is the city of Chicago losing culturally without this rough experimental style on stage to kind of perfect?
Yeah, I really truly believe that these 10 months of the artists being quarantined is we're going to see some unbelievable music and artistry come out of this. So some of us have been streaming, and I think that when we are able to reopen, I think it's going to be an avalanche of just wonderful music. But to Joe's point earlier, what was really important to us is that not just the venues in Chicago, the independent venues in Chicago being saved, but it had to happen across the country, because even if you're a smaller band from Chicago, you're still going to tour out like the Midwest, or even as you start to grow. So what was imperative to all of us is that we all collectively survive this, because it's a very complicated ecosystem. So if you only were left with like the larger venues, it doesn't work, and vice versa. And then, you know, across the country.
So much to factor in. But you know what? Music, I'm just thinking, in large part, is about hope. It's hope to heal from the past, hope for a better future. What are you two looking forward to when it comes to music in 2021? And I'll start with you, Joe.
I think that I am looking forward to that first weekend. And I think that the fans will come out in droves. I really do think people are starved for this experience. The communal music experience is something that cannot be replaced. And I think that's part of why,
absolutely,
that's why we're successful in our call to action with Springfield and with Washington, is that people know that this economic cultural engine is something not to be forgotten or be abandoned.
It's funny, Tanya, we all talk about it, like, what do you, you know, where do you want to go? What do you want to do when it first reopens? And for me, I just want to be on a sweaty dance floor, dancing, dancing, dancing. Yeah.
Well, I am here for
it. We're all in this
it.
Together.
We're all in this together, and man, do I look forward to that time. Katie Tutton, co-owner of The Hideout, and Joe Shanahan, owner of The Metro, two independent venues in Chicago. Thank you again to you both.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for having us.
President-elect Joe Biden is set to be inaugurated. This transition of power comes a week after President Trump was impeached for inciting an insurrection. As the White House shifts to Biden, the NPR Politics podcast will be there every day to break down the biggest news from Washington.
The Senate is gearing up for the impeachment trial of Donald Trump, but another impeachment effort is underway in Kentucky, where the Republican-led state legislature has formed a committee to review a petition to impeach Democratic Governor Andy Beshear. The complaint was filed by four citizens who opposed the governor's restrictions during the pandemic. Republicans say state law compels them to take all impeachment petitions seriously. But as Ryland Barton from Kentucky Public Radio reports, they're using a different process for handling impeachment petitions, and this change comes as lawmakers have been angling to strip Beshear of his powers.
On the first day of the legislative session here in Kentucky, protesters placed yard signs outside of the Capitol building that read, "Impeach Andy." One of them had a sinister message on the back, "Make hanging traitors great again," along with a postscript affixed in tape, a short length of rope. A couple days later, four citizens filed a petition in the Republican-led State House of Representatives calling for Governor Andy Beshear to be impeached, saying his coronavirus orders violated the state constitution. The House quickly formed a special committee to review the petition. Jason Nemes is the committee's Republican chair. He says state law requires that all impeachment petitions be reviewed.
This, in my view, is a solemn duty that we have. A petition for impeachment of our governor has been filed. We've never impeached a governor. We will not have unfairness in this committee.
But this isn't how impeachment petitions are usually handled in Kentucky. Anna Weitz is an attorney who worked for former Democratic State House Speaker Greg Stumbo. She says they used to get a lot of petitions asking for various elected officials to be removed.
The stack of impeachment petitions was probably, and I'm not kidding, probably up to my elbow. It was probably 4 feet tall.
But instead of forming a special committee, the House would send the petitions to an existing committee for review. Weitz says usually they wouldn't go anywhere.
I don't recall any petitions going to full hearing, maybe once or twice, but I think primarily they were reviewed by the chairperson or chair and vice chair and determined not to be worth moving forward on.
The current petition claims Governor Beshear violated the rights of millions of Kentuckians by ordering the closure of churches and non-essential businesses to in-person traffic early on in the pandemic, restricting out-of-state travel, and expanding mail-in voting during the 2020 elections. The state Supreme Court already ruled that Beshear had the power to impose the restrictions during the state of emergency after Kentucky's Republican Attorney General sued to limit them. Beshear says that by considering the petition, the legislature is lifting up voices of people trying to undermine democracy.
And whether this was something filed against me or anybody else, going out there and playing patty cake with these so-called militias that stormed our U.S. Capitol and murdered a D.C. Capitol police officer and that put everybody else in danger is just wrong.
The ease with which the impeachment committee was created has opened the door for others seeking to remove elected officials in Kentucky. A group of eight citizens has filed a petition to have Republican State Representative Robert Goforth removed. He's been indicted for assault and strangulation charges after he allegedly hogtied his wife with an Ethernet cord last year and threatened to kill her. Those charges are pending, and Goforth was easily reelected after the incident. The new impeachment committee says they'll consider that petition as well. For Here and Now, I'm Ryland Barton in Louisville.
Treasury Secretary nominee Janet Yellen says now is the time to act big to help revive the economy.
Economists don't always agree, but I think there is a consensus now. Without further action, we risk a longer, more painful recession now and longer-term scarring of the economy later.
That's Yellen from her confirmation hearing today. She's urging lawmakers to pass President-elect Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion economic relief package, despite concerns about the proposal's large price tag and the mounting national debt. And for more, let's bring in NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Tanya.
We heard a little bit from Yellen, but how does she plan to convince lawmakers that borrowing more money to help Americans get through the worst of this pandemic will actually be worth it in the long run?
Well, her argument is that the cost of inaction would be even higher. There's a sense that as impressive as it was that we got these potentially very effective vaccines developed in record time, they've been slow getting into people's arms, so they want to speed that up. But even with that, there's going to be, you know, more months before the economy is ready to reopen. And in the meantime, there are some 18 million people on unemployment. There are small businesses that are struggling. And the proposal here is to extend a lifeline to those families and struggling businesses to keep them afloat until the vaccines get out and can do their work.
Mm-hmm. Yellen is expected to have an easy confirmation. She is highly regarded on both sides of the aisle, having been the first woman to lead the Federal Reserve and also chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. But she is likely to face opposition from some lawmakers in pushing Biden's broader economic agenda through Congress. What obstacles do you think she'll likely face?
Well, there is opposition to some pieces of this $1.9 trillion proposal, both some of the short-term pieces and the long-term pieces. There were questions raised in the committee hearing today about, for example, the $1,400 relief payments. Some lawmakers don't think that's particularly well targeted. Then there are also pieces of this package that are not really directly tied to the pandemic, like the push for a $15 minimum wage. So those are likely to see some opposition, especially from Republicans in the Senate.
I have just about a minute with you. I want to ask you about this. Yellen was also asked about the Biden administration's approach to the U.S. dollar. President Trump wanted a weaker dollar during his presidency. What impact does the value of the dollar actually have on the economy overall?
Yeah, a weaker dollar makes it easier for U.S. exporters to sell their products abroad. It makes U.S. exports more competitive on the international market, and that's why President Trump has advocated for that. But Yellen touted sort of the traditional U.S. party line, which is that currency valuation should be set by markets and that no country should deliberately devalue its currency in the interest of boosting exports.
NPR Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're very welcome.
So, question, can an employer require employees to get a coronavirus vaccine? The more people get vaccinated, the quicker the pandemic is tamped down. That's how vaccines work. You've long had to show proof of some vaccines when you travel to certain countries. Kids have to have certain shots at most schools. Airlines are already starting to require flyers to show proof they've tested negative, and soon airlines, sports arenas may ask for proof of a vaccination. So, can employers require employees to roll up their sleeves? If I understand it correctly, the answer is yes, no, and maybe. Dorit Rice is a law professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. She specializes in vaccine law policy. Professor Dorit, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we see ethicists arguing this. This seems to be a really tough one with the coronavirus vaccines, having to do with the fact that they have emergency use, at least from the U.S. government. Talk a little bit about how that might complicate things.
So there's legal uncertainty on whether you can mandate a vaccine under an emergency use authorization. On one hand, the law says you have to let recipients know that they can refuse the vaccine and any consequences of that. So that would imply that they have to have a choice. On the other hand, the law does say that there could be consequences, and it says nothing to employers. So it's not directed at employers at all. It gives us conflicting signals, and it has never been before a court. So normally employers can mandate, so maybe they can mandate here too. On the other hand, because this is new ground, because this is vaccine that hasn't completed 2 years of testing, then maybe we can't require it.
Right, which is why you have the ethicist, our friend Dr. Arthur Kaplan, saying, hey, these are basically experimental drugs. You know, a requirement would never hold up to a legal challenge, but you also have your fellow law professor Peter Myers of George Washington University Law School saying, look, the FDA says, as you just said, the recipient or their caregiver has the option to accept or refuse, and this is the Pfizer vaccine, but as you just said or alluded to, it says you have the right to refuse, then it doesn't also say that you still have the right to work.
Employers, especially private employers, have the right to decide who will work for them, and part of that right is trying to create a safe environment. So one question is, if you require your workers to give the vaccine and something happens to a worker, there's both an ethical problem and there might be liability under workers' compensation. On the other hand, if you don't require the vaccine from your workers and one of them infects another worker or a customer, again, you face an ethical problem and potential liability.
But I guess my question is, if the FDA is saying that somebody has the right to refuse a vaccination and doesn't seem to go further there, can an employer fire them and say, you have every right not to take the shot? I'm not going to hold you down and force you to take the shot. But our workforce needs to be protected. That's my right. And so I'm going to fire you. In other words, there's a muddy area there, isn't there?
There is a muddy area. And it's going to probably end up with some employers doing exactly that and this ending before a judge. And a judge could go either way. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the agency that advises employers about discrimination in the workplace, has a guidance that suggests that, yes, you can mandate a vaccine under an EUA. And to remind you, employers have been mandating testing, and many of the tests are still under an EUA too. But it's still a risk if it goes to court.
Well, and is there another middle ground where an employer might realize that it's a, you know, right now it's just a legal jungle that we don't yet understand, and they might say, okay, I'm going to require that my workers all get vaccinated, except if they have a medical or a religious exception or a disability. And with those people and anyone who's refusing to get a vaccine, I will insist on this, whether it's wearing a mask or sitting apart from everyone. In other words,
yes. So there's a little bit of a distinction there. People with medical exceptions and people with religious objections, they have a legal right to be accommodated. And one accommodation may be you can come to work, but you need to wear PPE. So yes, you could say, get the vaccine or wear PPE, get the vaccine or you're going to be the one that works remotely or the one that works separate from everybody else.
Can someone refuse that and still keep their job?
That's up to the employer. The employer can say, this is your option. You can vaccinate, put an extra PPE. I will not employ you if you refuse both of them.
Yeah. Do you think we're going to see this, you know, that scenario, for instance, in court?
I think we will. And we have seen that in the influenza mandate context, where some employees challenge the mask mandate. Most of the time, it's unsuccessful.
And how about, we know the dollar store, for instance, which is a huge chain, is already giving an additional compensation, money, to employees to get a vaccination. For some, it's hardship. They have to leave work, or, you know, they have to pay mm-hmm. for it, whatever it might be. Does that run into any trouble if it's seen as paying off workers to get them to vaccinate?
It's actually very appropriate for a workplace to give incentives for things that they consider healthy behavior. For example, employers can have wellness programs in which they give bonuses to workers that participate in stopping smoking programs and so forth. Giving money for vaccinating can be seen as a wellness program. You're giving a financial incentive for people to do things that keep them healthy.
Fascinating. Dorit Rice, law professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, specializing in vaccine law. Professor Rice, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The messaging app Signal is back online after a wave of new users crashed their servers over the weekend. Millions of people have flocked to apps like Signal and Telegram over privacy concerns with WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, and because of the political fallout from the insurrection. Ronnie Mola has been following this. She's a data reporter for Recode, and she joins us now. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Yes, absolutely. So remind us what these apps do. They tout their end-to-end encryption. Explain what that is and why it makes them stand out from these other messaging apps.
So apps like Signal and WhatsApp have end-to-end encryption, which means that if you were to be hacked, someone wouldn't be able to see the content of your message. The message should only be able to be read by the person sending it and the person you're sending it to. Unless, of course, someone actually has your phone, then that's a different story.
Mm-hmm. What kind of growth have they seen over these last few days? How many new users?
Oh, it's been huge. I think Signal hit something like 50 million installs on Google Play, and this is like tens of millions within a day or two. Just huge growth, so much so that, as you said before, they were offline for about 24 hours.
Ronnie, you know, some people, as we know, are proactively seeking out more privacy, but a lot of the latest rush to these apps was reactive after users of WhatsApp got a notification that many thought was basically an overhaul of their privacy policy. And Facebook has clarified that WhatsApp messages are encrypted and that personal information would not be shared on Facebook. How big of a driver was that in what we're seeing now? And are these apps actually more private than WhatsApp?
I think that was actually a pretty big driver. As you said, the update actually doesn't mean that anyone's going to be able to read your messages or that they're going to share any more information with Facebook. I think there's just the perception that, you know, WhatsApp is owned by Facebook and Facebook is this big company that sucks up lots of data. Why wouldn't they suck up WhatsApp's too? So when this privacy update came, people thought, oh no, you know, all of a sudden this isn't as secure. So they're moving to other apps like Signal, which is really secure. And then Telegram isn't end-to-end encrypted by default. That means that someone could hack into your conversations potentially, unless if you set up the end-to-end encryption, which a lot of people don't do if it's not done by default. Mm. I wanted to make a distinction between Signal and Telegram. These are like the top one and two messaging apps. Telegram has a much bigger sort of social media component. They have these channels that people could follow. Signal is much more just I message you or I message a group of people.
Yeah, that distinction is important. Thank you for that. There are also these political reasons why people are rushing to these apps. Some Facebook users are ditching WhatsApp in part because they're protesting what they see as Facebook's role in the storming of the Capitol earlier this month. And users of the self-described free speech site Parler, which Apple and Google, as we know, kicked off their services after the insurrection, have also flocked to Signal and Telegram. But there are concerns that it will be harder to track extremists on these private messaging apps than it already is on some of these semi-public ones. So what are the risks with this uptick of private encrypted messaging?
You know, the nature of encrypted messages just means that no one can read them. So, you know, that's a plus and a minus. You might not want outsiders to be able to read your messaging, but then obviously it makes it harder to track extremists. It's harder to track people you know, maybe using these smaller group chats in order to coordinate violence. It's definitely a double-edged sword.
Ronnie, we also know there are real concerns that down the road, law enforcement could be given special access to these encrypted messaging apps. And we know that marginalized groups and people who live under oppressive governments use them as a form of safe communication. I mean, the concerns around this is valid, right?
Oh, absolutely. Every time you see sort of political or social unrest, you see a lot of downloads for these encrypted apps. And, you know, there's a real reason and function for them. People could use it for, you know, really valid protests, but they could also use it for coordinating violence at the Capitol.
Have you seen a lot of chatter about this being a real possibility that law enforcement agencies and maybe lawmakers will be taking a deeper look at these encrypted services as a way to keep tabs on these extremist groups?
I certainly think that law enforcement will try to do what they can to keep track of these different groups. I know that they're looking at more public channels on Telegram. Obviously, things like Signal, which are encrypted, you know, they can't actually get that much information out of. I believe Signal had been subpoenaed before, and all they were able to say was this was the last time the person used the app, and this is when they signed up for it. So there's only a certain amount of information that's even kept in the first place.
Do you think this new user base increase is permanent, and what have Signal and Telegram said about it?
I do think this is part of a larger trend of people moving to more privacy-focused apps in general. Everyone's looking for some sort of privacy because, you know, so much of our lives are online and essentially public in a way. These companies that are getting this new influx of users, they're excited. You know, Signal is, they would love a much more private online world. And you know, they're celebrating the number of new users. Telegram is also celebrating. I think they hit something like 500 million active users recently.
That's Ronnie Mola, senior data reporter for Recode. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.